This episode was brought to you by Audible.com. You can go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty and sign up for a 1 month free trial membership. You get a free audiobook out of the deal and you support this podcast. Thanks for listening, guys, and hope you enjoy the interview.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But to Krell forgot one thing, it's monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3. 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 126.
Snowshoe cats aren't anywhere near as adorable as I am.
Really? That's what you came up with in 15 seconds.
Hey, I think that's pretty good for 15 seconds.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Jen.
And our very, very super special guest is Mike Cole. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Glad to be back.
So before we talk about the book, you've got stuff you want to talk about first. So we're going to do that.
Snowshoe cats, I just found out about them. They're a really, really fabulous breed. And what's amazing about them is that they actually wear little tiny snowshoes and use them to walk in cold climates.
I think you should focus on them prominently in your next book.
That definitely. Are you kidding? Yeah. I mean, that is going to be the topic. Forget Shadow Ops. It's going to be Snowshoe Cat Ops.
You are writing book number 4, right?
I am writing book number 4.
Can you make a character who has a cat?
You know, it's funny.
Cats,
because
I have to cut in here, because cats actually figure fairly prominently, period, in science fiction and fantasy. Sean has actually focused a number of blog posts on the popular cats in science fiction and fantasy.
One blog post.
It would only be appropriate for you to pay homage to the greats that have come before you with a cat that wears snowshoes.
Well, you know, I think that there are really three things that, I mean, I've been very, very fortunate to be quite successful in my writing career, but I really think there are three things that are holding me back from the kind of, you know, George R. R. Martin-esque success that I desire. And the first is that I do not have a beard. But can I just get to the punchline before you move?
No, you can't.
I mean, like, I'm setting up the joke. I haven't even finished the joke.
I know. Okay, go ahead. So you don't have a beard. That's definitely an oversight on your part.
Yeah, I don't have two middle initials. Like, I'm not Mike or R. Cole or...
Oh, yeah.
And I, there are no cats in any of my stories.
You had me at beard.
Wouldn't it be hard as a man in the military to have a beard? Isn't that against regulations?
Well, I mean, it would be...
Unless you're special ops.
Well, yeah, some of those guys will grow beards. Yes, it is against regulations. I'm allowed to grow a mustache no farther out than the corners of my mouth.
Yeah, no offense. Don't do that again.
Oh, yeah, I won't do that. What do you mean again? Oh, yeah, that's right. You saw that picture.
I have seen the pictures of you with a mustache. I'm not a big mustache person myself, because, you know, I was married to a military man, still am married to him. He's just not military anymore. And the times that he has attempted to grow a mustache have been hilarious on their own. But yeah, no mustaches.
All right.
Unless you're doing it for the what is it called? Movember?
Movember.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's totally acceptable.
Okay.
Okay. So basically, we've already confirmed that you will Tuckerize my cat in your next book.
Done. Forget Tuckerize your cat. Your cat is going to be the inspiration for every word I write from this episode on.
Okay. I'm sure he'll appreciate that. It'll go to his head, though.
What's your cat's name?
Winston.
Oh, there you go.
Oh, forget it. I'm sorry. All of that was before I knew your cat's name. No, that's done.
And so. Here I thought Winston was like the best name ever, so what do I know?
No, no. I always thought Cantankerous would be the best name for a cat.
Oh, Cantankerous?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. I always thought Bipolar would be a good, you know, name. But maybe that's just with my cat, who 1 minute will be, I love you, and the next is, no. I want to eat your face. Right,
whoa, 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 whoa. We are now actually talking about cats. Gotta move on.
Totally yeah. Unacceptable, okay. Unless it is science fiction or fantasy or Michael related. So.
Like I'm happy with some science fiction tropes. We're getting a little too close to the bone here. No way.
Okay, all right. So let's go to the two things that you really wanted to talk about, Mike. So the first is some sort of, like, game thing that you did where you, like, sat around the table and you, like, scratched your belly button or something. I don't know.
And we're nerds.
Yes. Last year at Epic Confusion, which is the biggest fan run con in the Midwest, held in the vicinity of Detroit every year, we did an author D&D game. And it was at the last minute, Peter V. Brett, the author of The Demon Cycle, came up with an idea. Wouldn't it be cool with all of these authors who are friends at this con to sit down and have a D&D game? And then he and I began to pile on to that idea, and we wound up coming up with the plan to do a first edition game with a Gary Gygax authored classic module. We wound up choosing B1, Keep on the Borderlands, if you remember that. And at the last minute, we actually got a camera, and Justin J. Diddy Esquire, who runs the Staffers Musing Book Review blog, filmed it, and we did, let's see who was playing. It was myself and Saladin Ahmed, co-DMs as the newbie writers, and then the players were Peter Brett, Brent Weeks, Pat Rothfuss, Joe Abercrombie, Jim Hines, Elizabeth Baer, Jay Lake, Scott Lynch. I think that was it. There may be more, and I apologize if I forgot someone. So it was a real gathering of, like, a lot of science fiction and fantasy luminaries. And John Scalzi came in the middle of the game and handed someone a pair of panties. I don't remember why, but he didn't stay to play. And so then this year we did it again, also with a classic first edition module authored by Gary Gygax. We did T1, The Village of Hamlet, which a lot of people remember. And it was again myself and Saladin DMing, and the players now were Peter V. Brett, Pat Rothfuss, Jim Hines, Diana Rowland, Mary Robinette Kowal, Sam Sykes, and then the last seat was auctioned off to raise money for Pat Rothfuss's World Builders charity, which partners with Heifer International to provide sustainable careers to people in developing countries. It's a fabulous, fabulous charity. We were able to raise money for it. And then in the midst of the planning for it, the Axe of Whimsy campaign to support Jay Lake, who is a beloved science fiction and fantasy author who's currently battling cancer and successfully so far, and I think that's wonderful. So Mary Robinette Kowal showed up with Hawaiian shirts for all of us. And anyone who knows Jay Lake knows that he is famous for his Hawaiian shirts. So our act of whimsy was to wear these Hawaiian shirts for some people wore them for the whole game. I got overheated about halfway through and had to take mine off. But it was really, really cool and really, really touching. And unlike last year, instead of having sort of a last-minute camera thing thrown together, we hired a professional documentary film crew to come in and film it. And they are, as we speak, editing it down to a video that will be released publicly, I hope, sometime in the next couple of months. And it was just an absolute blast. And the thing about it is, Saladin and I, when we go into this, you know, we do a lot of planning up front because we're both terrified because, I mean, let's face it, you have some of the most powerful egos and especially powerful creative egos. And what is a game of Dungeons and Dragons but a giant act of creation? So, you know, I'm not going to tell Pat Rothfuss what to do. You know, he's not together at the thought of that. No, that's, you know, the story shouldn't go that way is essentially what I'm saying. You know, I'd like to think we managed to pull it off. You'll have to judge when we see the video. And, of course, fumbles were rolled at such good times in the game that one would think that we planned it. We didn't. And likewise with critical hits. And there's some real comedy gold on this. And, frankly, you know, a lot of us were saying we got done. We wish it had gone longer. We only had 3 hours. And
well, that's way too short of a D&D game.
Yeah, it really is. And we really, a lot of us, it was kind of a transporting experience, and it felt a lot like you know, playing games in my mom's basement when I was in junior high, when I sort of was beginning to cut my teeth as a nerd. It was a sublime experience, and I'm really, really looking forward to what people think of that video when it comes out.
Well, I mean, we've talked a lot about how much of an influence that Dungeons & Dragons has had on so many authors of the current generation that are out there. And obviously, I mean, you and Stina, and I would say that at least half the people that we've spoken to on this podcast have come out of the sort of Dungeons & Dragons world of, and that act of creation, as you mentioned. Because it is, you know, it's sort of an intensified experience where a condensed, you know, creative process. And it's usually people that are too shy to, like, get up on stage and be an actor, potentially. But they're willing to do it in the, you know, confines of a room around a table with people that they know and are friends with. And that's, you know, like, I always sucked at it because I'm a terrible actor. But I loved watching everybody else going through the creation process. Now, my question is what is going to happen with the video once it is released? Is it going to be another fundraising effort for world builders, or is it going to be for something else?
No, our intention was always, and of course, the final disposition is up to Pete, right. Peter Brett. But my understanding is that it will just simply be made available to everyone. You know, there's just a lot of joy in that game, and we want to get it out there and share it with people. Pat Rothfuss does a video show on Geek and Sundry, which is Felicia Day's YouTube channel, called Storyboard. And we had, and I honestly think that the people playing the game view D&D as part of the creative process and the storytelling process, just for the reasons you just mentioned. And we really just, we had a great time and we want to share it with other people. And next year, I'm fairly sure, because it is shaping up to be an annual thing, we do it again, it's going to be a panel, meaning that we're going to have an audience so that people at the con can sit there and watch and maybe heckle while we play. Again, I can't promise that. It's some of that's
hilarious.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
I might have to go to that, except that I'm not probably going.
Well, it would make me very happy if one of you would come out to that. I'm totally serious. Where do you guys live in relation to Detroit?
Far away.
Far, far, far away.
I'm in Florida. Jen's in Cali.
Yeah, so.
You guys couldn't be farther away.
No.
Which is why we're going to WorldCon this year, because it's in San Antonio.
Well, yeah. Sean, I'll make you a deal. If you, just because you're male, if you come on out to Detroit, I will room with you if that'll help you save money.
What, but, you can't room with chicks?
Nope, I'm not gonna
do
that.
You got like an issue with that?
Nope.
Seriously?
I think
I'm offended.
Well, you shouldn't be. Look, you know, I'm not gonna share a bathroom with you, and I'm not gonna share a room with you. Sorry, how I roll.
Oh my god.
But you'll share a room with some dude you've never even met. Who may very well be a serial killer.
There are some baseline rules, and those are that we are both nude at all times and covered in salad oil. That's
my god.
That's the limit.
I'm sorry. You have a problem with women that's nude and covered in salad oil? Is that too much for your masculinity? That, you know, we might actually be sexier nude and covered in salad oil than you?
Look, I simply have a objection to choices in salad oil that I've experienced in the past with women. That's all.
That you think women might make. Oh, I see. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. This podcast is officially the gay Skiffy and Fanti show.
I don't know what you guys are talking about. There's nothing gay about this whatsoever.
Okay.
No.
Every time you come on, Mike, I will say something like you're an attractive man, or...
Wait, Sean, hold on. I forgot the other condition apart from the naked salad oil stuff, which is that we have Spartacus running on constant loop on the hotel phone.
Oh, okay.
Oh my god. Are we in the same salad bowl?
Something about a bowl.
Oh my goodness. I think we're going to have to cut this. I'm just saying.
Okay, let's move on. But that would be really cool if I can ever get up there. That would be awesome.
Anything I can do to...
Minus the nakedness and salad oil.
Oh my God.
Not that I would have objections to it. I'd just be sitting there taking pictures and laughing my ass off, but, you know, whatever. No pictures allowed, I'm sure.
I would be willing for charity to pretend that we're nude in a giant salad bowl. For a picture, which would then be for charity. I would be okay with that.
Are you referring to the Young Flandry pose that just came out with Mary Robinette Kowal, Patrick Rothfuss, Jim Hines, John Scalzi, and Charlie Strauss?
Yes.
I have not.
You haven't seen the new one? Oh, it's great.
It's awesome. It is so awesome.
It's so great. Whoa. So
goodness.
Yes. Yeah, so you should go see that. I'll try to put a link to it if I get it up to this. But anyway, so the next thing, Mike, you would like to talk about?
Yes. So this is a really cool story. How long ago was this? She was like 97? No. Yeah, like 96 and 97. I was living in D.C. going to grad school, and I had a roommate, this guy named Chris. And at the time, actually, it was interesting. I wasn't in the military, and he was a private in the Army Reserve. And, you know, we roomed together, and then, you know, I moved on with my life, and we lost touch. And about a year ago, or maybe a little longer, he found me on Facebook and got back in touch and was like, hey, man, I see that you're a writer. And, you know, I work for this company that makes book trailers. And
they have whole companies dedicated to book trailers?
Yeah.
Well, they do. They do product videos and stuff like that.
Oh, okay. That makes
sense. But anyway, I was like, oh, you know, that's cool. But I didn't think anything of it, you know. And, of course, I didn't think it was serious because, frankly, every book trailer I've ever seen in my life sucks. I mean, I've sort of come to the belief that there's no such thing as a good book trailer. And I don't just mean like mildly sucks. I mean like, you know, hey, I think I'll hire my 8th grade niece to make this, even though you're a New York Times bestselling author, bad.
All seem to resemble something that would come out of the 1970s bad science fiction scene.
They are horrible. They are the production quality is horrible. The art choices are horrible. The sound is horrible. Like, I've just yet to see a book trailer that I felt was up to snuff. And I think I'm not the only person who thinks this, because it's sort of like a running joke in the science fiction and fantasy community about how bad all book trailers are. So, you know, at first I took it with a grain of salt. And, you know, then one night I said, I should check this out. And I went on his website. And sure enough, there were book trailers there. But they were also book trailers for seriously heavy-hitting authors. We're talking like Ryan Holiday and Seth Godin. These are nonfiction authors who are, you know, frankly, big cheeses. And the trailers that were made for them were really, really amazing. And all of a sudden, I was like, whoa, you've got my attention. So I told him that I'd be interested in working with him on it, and I sent him a copy of my book. And we started sort of planning ideas, and I came up with a script, and, you know, we started thinking things through. And then for about a year, he was like, yeah, you know, I'm really snowed under, because they were getting a lot of business because they do amazing work. And it reached a point where I was thinking, you know what, they're not going to have time to fit me into their schedule. We're not going to be able to work this project. And then just about a month ago, you know, the voice actors are hired and I'm getting voiceovers, and then I'm starting to get cutscenes of animation, and a project manager is emailing me and saying, hey, what artists, you know, in comic books do you like so that we can try to find the right look for you? And then we're, you know, I'm having hour long conversations with Chris trying to refine the script. And then sure enough, a week ago, I have a book trailer, and it is amazing. Amazing. My military fantasy Shadow Ops universe orbits around a fictional military unit called the SOC, the Supernatural Operations Corps. And one of their biggest challenges is convincing latent people, people who can channel magic, to obey the law and report their abilities to the SOC and register and join up, as opposed to going selfer and running and using magic on their own, which is illegal and what the SOC spends most of its time chasing. And Chris, when we started brainstorming this, really was set on the idea of doing a military recruiting video for the SOC, the kind of video that the SOC would put out on television and on the internet to try to, you know, a propaganda piece, if you will. And we were kicking back and forth real military videos. Most recently, people are probably remember the one the United States Marine Corps put out where they're running bringing food aid, you know, into the distance and obviously into a battle scene. And the call to action tagline at the end is, which way would you run? Which I found totally inspiring because I know the answer to that me. So so we came up with it. And unfortunately, I cannot show your listeners because you are an audio-only podcast. However, I can play the sound. And just getting the music and the voiceover, I think people will get a feeling for it. And it's less than a minute. So do you mind if I run that by you?
Go for it.
All right, here we go.
The Great Reawakening has changed everything. Like it or not, Americans have a choice. Be part of the problem. Or part of the solution. Selfer or hero. Make the right choice. Report your abilities. Join the Supernatural Operations Corps. Our gifts for our nation.
Awesome.
Isn't
so cool. So what I particularly loved about this was, you know, the whole, like you said, with that Marine video that kind of, you know, shows them distributing food aid and everything. That's what this focused on was, you know, how that it can be helpful. It shows them, you know, the fire, the pyromancer lighting a fire for a homeless guy or something. And I really liked that intonation. And one of the comments that popped up on your page was someone was referring to how it reminded them of Starship Troopers, which people who listen to this podcast know is one of my favorite movies of all time. Because of the cutscenes that were brilliantly done, I thought, in terms of advertising for the psych operations and things like that. And I think it did a great job of, you know, even though the story, your books focus on the illegal portion, you know, like, that's really on the selfers who they go a little bit crazy, or not really crazy, but that's how they're viewed by the military. This went with it can be positive. You can help people out. I think it was pretty effective.
Well, thanks. Yeah. I mean, one of the things I firmly believe, and this is funny, Ben Delano, who runs the Reader Writer podcast, was interviewing me at Confusion because I'm incredibly important and everybody wants to listen to me talk.
I didn't mean to laugh about that.
No, it's all right. It's all right. And one of the things he asked me, he does a thing which I think is really cool, is he'll go around a con and he'll ask every author one question and get like a 15-second answer and then string them all together and make a podcast. And his question for this time was, what do you like in an antagonist? And my immediate answer was, I want the antagonist to be the hero of his own story. I want the antagonist to truly, truly believe that what he or she is doing is right. And I want that argument to make sense. I want the heroes and the antagonist, the protagonist, the antagonist's loggerheads. Frankly, you as the reader could pick either side. That's what makes a great story to me, because that's how life works. I mean, I'm a firm believer that there's almost, I mean, only in very rare circumstances are things actually evil. Most of the time, people are either frightened or mistaken or ambitious in some way or another. And so one of the things that I really was excited about this video is that, yeah, the SOC really is the antagonist of of the Shadow Ops series, but this is what they believe, that magic is dangerous, that it harms people. They call them selfers because they believe that it is a selfish act to take your to attempt to use these potentially deadly powers for yourself instead of putting them at the service of your country. And I think the video really, really captures that perspective and gives that other point of view, apart from just being totally awesome.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's nice to see, especially with the new book, which we can kind of roll into at this point. You've taken a shift in tone, and you've split the Fortress Frontier into two stories. The story of your original antagonist, I guess you could call him, Oscar Britton. And now you have a new one, Colonel Bookbinder, who I am madly in love with, by the way.
Oh, so wow.
He's sexier than Oscar Britton at this point.
Is that because he looks like George Clooney on the cover?
That's part of the reason. But no, I like a family man. I mean, you got to look at some, I'm a mom, I've got a husband, I've got two children. Sure. You know, it's like I put myself in the role of his wife to an extent. And and seeing him, you know, kind of take that the step up, watching his process, which to me is almost a, you know, it's a Frodo-like adventure that he's going through in this book, where he starts out, you know, uncomfortable with himself. You know, he knows his place in the world. He's a paper pusher, and he's comfortable with that. He's totally, completely happy with that. He's like, you know, Frodo or Bilbo sitting in their hole and happily puttering away. And I liked that. You know, I can totally empathize with that position. But then he's forced into this completely new world, and he goes on the adventure. He goes on the quest. And, like, I'm only partway through the quest right now. And it's been really nice to watch him take those steps and also changing the environment around him. Because, obviously, part of the problem that Oscar Britton is having is that who he is not something that, you know, in the previous book, he is taken in and he's trapped in his position because of the fact that he has these powers and the government wants to use them for their own purposes. And so in the second book, obviously he's trying to kind of change that. Well, it seems to me that Bookbinder is changing that merely by showing the positive side of having power, being in power, and how it can be used for good. Maybe that's just my weird impression of the story, but I mean,
no, everyone
have any intention of that. I mean, I know you hate intentions, but
I mean, everyone's, I
guess that's where you've gone with it to an extent.
Everyone's interpretation of a work is valid. I really firmly believe that once a story leaves my hands, what a reader takes from it is this. I would never say, I mean, you could say, hey, I really felt that, you know, with Alan Bookbinder, you were talking about, you know, you were using an allegory here to talk about snowshoe cats and the struggles that they've had in being accepted as a AKC breed. That would have to be a valid thing because that's what you got out of it. I can't control it.
It would be really interesting if a cat was trying to get to be an AKC breed too. So
yeah, that, I mean, well, would be, yeah,
an interesting thing.
Well, I mean, this is fantasy we're talking about, Jen. So
that's true.
No, but you're right. I wouldn't say that Alan Bookbinder is comfortable being a paper pusher. I think Alan Bookbinder is very insecure because it would be one thing if he was a paper pusher in a bank. He's a paper pusher in the army, right. And I think that he's very self-conscious of his rank, the fact that he's such a high-ranking officer, despite the fact that he's really never fired a round in anger, and feels that very keenly. Sort of against his will, gets to put that to the test and see what happens. I think there is an old movie with starring Michael Caine called Zulu, which was made in the 70s.
Oh my gosh, right? Yeah.
Well, it deals with a real historical event, which was the Battle of either Isiolando or Rorke's Drift. I can't remember which one, but it's a true story. There was a convalescent hospital built in a mission station on the Buffalo River in Africa. And there were, I guess, 50 to 100 badly wounded British soldiers that were recovering there. And there was a lieutenant, I think his name was Chard, who was with the Royal Engineers, who was surveying for a pontoon bridge. And he had no combat experience. He was an engineer. I mean, that was what he was there for. And while he happened to be there, 4,000 Zulus surrounded this mission station with the intention of wiping it out. And because Chard was the highest ranking guy on post, he was in command. And all I could think about was, you know, you go to work one day and life throws you something, which is both the greatest challenge and the greatest opportunity of your life. And what do you do with it? I think that that's a fascinating, fascinating question. And people who've studied the story of that battle, you know, Chard rose to the occasion and led one of the most studied and historic defenses in human history and repulsed this army against overwhelming odds. And I really, really wanted to explore that. I thought that was a really, really fascinating question. And Alan Bookbinder was a growth, an outgrowth of that. I think one of the things I wanted to capture is that, you know, I've now done three tours in Iraq, and been called up for three domestic disasters, the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, Hurricane Irene, and most recently Hurricane Sandy here in New York. And in all six cases, every single time I started out, I mean, I'll never forget in Deepwater Horizon, they put me in charge of this comms station, and I knew nothing about running this communication center. And I showed up, and it's this giant van covered with or trailer covered with antenna arrays, and it's staffed by a crew of like electronics technicians and computer guys and radio guys and watch standers that are like, all right, sir, what do we do? And I had no fucking idea, what we did. And, my solution was to, pull the chief aside and be like, well, what do we do, chief? And then pretend it was my idea, which is what really all good junior officers do, is the NCOs run the operation and you pretend that you're in charge. But I had a similar experience like that in every time I was in a crisis. And in every time I wondered, holy shit, what if I screw this up? And felt like that from the moment I arrived to the moment I left. And I really wanted to explore that through the eyes of someone else and in the fantasy setting I created in the Shadow Ops universe. That was the real impetus behind Alan Bookbinder, which frankly, Jan, is not really that far off from what you were saying, I think.
No, I don't think it is. I mean, the interesting thing about it is you really have created the perfect environment for this type of situation to occur. And at the end of your previous book, it was interesting to see, it's like, where are they going to go with this? Because that gate has been shut down. That there aren't that many portmasters available. So what's going to happen to that forward operation base? I was really satisfied that that's what you decided to take on. You didn't just stick with the Oscar Britton storyline of, what happens to him? What is he going to do? And you didn't leave him as the main answer to the problem that he created. You have put, Bookbinder into a position where he can take advantage of the situation. Well, not advantage of the situation, but he can at least competently deal with the situation, especially with his powers, which kudos to you on yet another power set.
That's something I was fascinated by, were not only the new powers, but also seeing other powers like being used in ways that, like, seeing them used in very unique ways, your use of physiomancy in sometimes very creepy ways because of the characters who happen to have the abilities. But I do have a question. I'll have a question about that later.
Okay,
You can ask that now.
No, I wanted to say something about Bookbinder.
Okay, fine, go ahead.
But are you done, Jen?
Yeah,
I'm done. Okay.
Can I respond to... There's two things there. Okay, I won't. I'll shut up.
I'm kidding. Go ahead, Mike.
There's two things that this is sort of a two pieces to that. The first is that I'm an author who's an ace author who's direct to mass market paperback. And historically, particularly in urban fantasy, that's been, there have been some enormous successes. And by that, I mean Patty Briggs, Jim Butcher. I think Charlene Harris was not straight to paperback. But all of those writers do what you described, Jen. They have a single protagonist that is the main feature, be it Sookie Stackhouse or Harry Dresden,
right,
that is the main feature of their book. And you get to know this person really, really well over the course of over 10 novels.
Yes.
And I never wanted to do that. All of my favorite writers, and look, this is not a dig against any of those authors. They're all amazing authors and incredibly successful, deservedly. But my most influential books and my favorite books have always been ensemble cast: George R. R. Martin, Joe Abercrombie, Peter Brett. These are all folks who have multiple POV protagonists. And in the case of George R. R. Martin, almost too many POV protagonists. And so I never wanted to do that in this. And I think that my editor at Ace was kind of like, what is this guy doing? And so, sure enough, book three, Breach Zone, will have a different protagonist. And book four, which is now under contract, will have a different protagonist. And that is by design. People are diverse and interesting, too diverse and interesting for me to focus on any one of them. So that was the answer to that. And then in terms of the magic system, I definitely, in Control Point, have set out a codified and rigid and rule-bound magic system. But one of the things I always kept in mind is that magic remains an elemental force, and that humans love to paste taxonomies over things, you know, mm-hmm. genus and phylum, like we do with the animal kingdom. But in the reality, that's just that's a convenience that we have developed for ourselves to help us make sense of a world that's often so big that it's overwhelming. In the end, the world functions as it functions. It's not interested in the taxonomies and tautologies and that we lay over it. So am I using the word tautology correctly?
Yeah, probably not.
Who cares? Hopefully folks understand what I mean. Anyway.
Our listeners wouldn't know the difference anyway.
Oh, that's insulting.
So you will see more of the diversity of magic in future books.
Good. I mean, it's been really interesting to see, like Sean said, I mean, I love the new Terramancer, for one thing.
Wound?
Yes, Wound. Thank you for putting in a strong female character. Always appreciate it. the Sculptor.
Yeah.
Right? And
Psycho.
You know, and just, you know, in Control Point, Therese is a fantastic character as it is. But the physiomancy that she goes through, and in this book, we even get a little bit more of what's going on with physiomancy. So that's been nice to see. But Bookbinder, that's a great power. And I think you're right. I mean, it is frustrating a lot of the time to have that sort of the very specific. And you had set yourself up to it to an extent with the very specific schools, which isn't not really setting yourself up for it, but setting the military and the government up for it, which was a nice, you know, dig at government classification systems.
Right.
Just saying. But I was going to ask, though, because since we're on the topic kind of magic, and I'm sorry, Sean, you're just going to have to ask your question sooner rather than later. What is your favorite school?
I've been asked that by a lot of people, and I dodge it every time. In the end, one of the things people always say, if you were latent, you know, what school would you want to be? And my answer is always, I would never want to be latent, because as cool as those powers are, to have them forever puts you outside society. Yeah. And, you are a tank. And you are a jet fighter, and you will never be able to have a normal relationship. And for example, Bookbinder's relationship with his wife, you get a glimpse of it here. You'll see more of what happens to it in Breach Zone as a result of him coming up laden. And, you know, look, I'm an extremely social, gregarious person. I'm unusual for a writer, I know, but my life turns on my relationships, and it turns on the people around me, and to be latent would mean that would all go away, and it would go away forever. And the thought of that is horrifying. So to dodge the answer, I wouldn't want to be latent.
Well, only in That's the context of the world you've created. You know, if we had a much nicer world in which people could have magic powers and they didn't have to worry about, you know, the government saying your powers are bad and we want to control them.
Okay, Jen, let's come back to reality for a minute.
Sorry. Yeah, I know. You're right.
You're still having a 3-month hissy fit over what to do about guns.
Yeah, I mean, that's true.
So
that's
imagine true. Now if anybody out there could suddenly have a power we can't actually take away, right, in which they could fry baby heads at any moment in time.
You know, one of the things
baby heads, by the way, you were talking about new schools of magic. Well, that would be a subset of pyromancy where it only works.
But that's what I'm saying, right, is, you know,
with guns,
we assume we can control it because we can take the guns away, et cetera, right?
You
can't control a magic power.
Right. In this case, you can't quite relate it to our conversation in the United States about gun rights. You have to more equate this with a conversation about gay rights, in my opinion.
No, and, because what being gay does not, like, if I have a relationship with Jake Gyllenhaal, just so you know, Jake, I'm looking out for you, that has no material effect on the rest of the world.
It's not dangerous. Okay, here, wait.
In and of itself, it's not dangerous. Now, if I happen to be...
That's true, except that people view it as dangerous.
Well, no, but that's completely... See, here's the difference, though. if I'm a pyromancer, I literally am dangerous because I can burn down your house and kill you. I can't kill you with my gay penis. That's never happened in the history of the world. Gay penis has never killed anybody. Or for gay vagina.
They certainly haven't burned down any houses. Gay penises.
See?
Gay
or vaginas, penises. Yes. Just so we're egalitarian, so we have gay penises
and
vagina.
Yeah, thank you.
Right. But that's the point,
however,
right?
They are still viewed as dangerous by certain segments of the
but
population.
That's because
and
people
gay people
who
are
view
viewed
gay
as dangerous.
As dangerous are insane.
Well, granted.
That's a different question.
But I still tend to relate the entire issue of the rights of latents in these books with gay rights. And like I said, maybe that's just me.
There's
but
an
I think
analogy
that
there,
are,
but it
there
falls
is,
apart, sure.
I don't
it
know.
It still falls apart
I'm
when
have
you
to think
deal
about
with the
more.
Material world. When you're dealing with the material world, you know, you can't control gay behavior. At least we assume we can't control it. Hell, who knows? Maybe we'll find out it's genetic
yeah,
defect.
Yeah, but okay, look at how Mike has written into the books the
yes.
fact that it can be controlled.
It can't be,
by
though.
Use
that's
of drugs.
Point.
No, he's got the limbic dampener within
right,
the book.
Right, but that assumes that people will take the limbic dampener.
That's true. You will learn more about the limbic dampener also in brief.
I'm sure.
But that's the point, right? Is we're dealing with things that are certain analogies to other kinds of rights issues we've battled. I mean, that's unavoidable, right? I mean, you're still going to run into the argument, you know, that the gay rights movement, right? They say that this is a natural thing for us, that it's not a choice. You just are gay, right? Well, that's going to be similar to somebody who's Latin. It's like, well, I didn't sit down and say, give me magic powers, and then I got them. I was born this way. So there is that analogy. But of course, where the arguments that are in favor of controlling those groups may have similarities, they actually have a more logical sense, even if I still disagree with it, the logical sense in a world in which powers exist, simply right. because those powers are demonstrably dangerous or potentially demonstrably dangerous, whereas somebody saying, like, if we let gay people have gay relationships, it'll ruin the country. It's like, well, the country's still here. And last I checked, gay people didn't fuck over the economy. So... In fact,
yeah, but, I mean, who's to say that people that are latent are actually going to destroy the world? There's no actual proof of that. You have no justification for that argument.
Oh my god!
Just saying. And I mean,
but
granted,
I have justification for the in this world that we know for a fact there are terrorists in this world who have power. Some of them are presumed to be terrorists. Some of them are maybe freedom fighters or whatever. But there are people in this world who go around and do cause a damage to society using those powers.
Well, there was an event before Control Point, which I allude to in Control Point, which is known as the Block Incident.
Right, that's in one of the little, like,
epigraphs. Quote things.
There you go, epigraphs, yeah.
And Helen Block was a high school age girl who came up latent in Aramancy and kept it to herself, was able to, she had strong personality, she was unusually mature for her age, and was able to master it enough to keep it under wraps without the aid of limbic dampener, and was fortunate enough to be from a small town where the SOC law enforcement component was, you know, the SOC is a very small core, and they have a hard time getting out to every place they should, and so she went undetected, and then they had, as part of the Heads Up program, a field trip to Washington, D.C., and no one really knows why she did it. Later on, when people were interviewed, some people said it had something to do with a boy. But when she was in the Lincoln Memorial, and she turned around, and what witnesses they were able to talk to said that the last thing she said was, "Look at me." And she spread her arms, and a wind came through that literally took the columns down, all of them. And people witnessing said it looked like dominoes coming down in a square, and the entire roof of the memorial collapsed. The entire memorial collapsed. 34 people were killed, including her. And that was sort of the magical 9/11 for the universe. And that was the real catalyst that gave Senators McGower and Lyndon the public support they needed to pass the act, which created the environment that you that you see in the Shadow Ops universe. So yeah, there definitely is, you know, an event. And the thing that was interesting about thinking that through is that, look, you know, for years after 9/11, I worked as a mercenary doing things that performing jobs that in the past were and now are again reserved entirely for the federal uniformed military warfighters and intelligence corps. Contractors didn't do that kind of work. But there was a brief period of time when we got a mandate from the public to do it. And it was driven by fear of events, catastrophic events like that. And that was a really strong influence in creating the kind that same kind of environment in the Shadow Ops universe. And one of the things I explore in Breach Zone is the backlash against that, much like the backlash against it that we had or that we have recently had that saw those powers taken away from private firms.
Right.
So basically, I'm right and you're wrong, Jen.
No, I could still argue this all day long, and I will. No, I'm kidding. I'm not going to argue it all day long.
But it is an interesting thing, and I'm sure Mike appreciates that. We're actually having a debate based on things we read in his book.
Yeah, I totally don't appreciate that. No, I'm kidding. No, I do. And one of the things, and this, and I just said this before, that I cannot control what people take away from my work. And it, one of the most fascinating things is to see what it kindles in other people based on what perspective they're bringing to it when they read it. So yeah, that is pretty cool and pretty gratifying to see.
And I just think it's really fascinating. I mean, because we'll be honest, like, you're not the only person to write about superpowers. These are essentially superpowers, although they're written in terms of being kind of like magic. But that you're not the only person to have addressed this question of, well, what the hell do we do with people who suddenly have these powers? I mean,
well,
the X-Men universe has essentially done it.
They've been doing it for 30 years, right?
Right. But I think what's fascinating about your work is that, you know, while the X-Men movies had to kind of update the X-Men universe to the contemporary time, you've written it even more so in the contemporary time, in the sense that, you know, we're dealing with very similar arguments we've kind of been hearing over the last decade or so about various levels of what do we do about people's rights. There's all sorts of questions about, you know, well, does the military have the right to do X? And what does the president, like, how much control is he allowed to have? And if he's doing things he's not supposed to, right? What is the response from the public? And so you've kind of grounded all of this in this very contemporary moment, or what feels like a very contemporary moment, and yet we're dealing with, you know, people with superpowers. And I mean, just to use this in an analogy, I really hate zombie shows that present worlds in which it's clear that nobody's ever seen a zombie movie, so people just make the same stupid bullcrap mistakes over and over. Your world does not feel like that. It feels like a world where, like, people sat down and thought, wait, we've been reading this stuff in comic books for a while, but we have to do something. And whether or not we, I mean, I think from a level of the principles that I support that are in the Constitution in terms of rights, I disagree wholeheartedly with a lot of the things that are presented in your book by the characters, not by you, but as their justification. But yet at the same time, I understand their responses. Because I understand, like, what the hell would we do if Jen and I showed up and suddenly we can melt baby heads, right?
Why do you always go to baby heads?
Yeah, it's sort of your go-to thing.
God!
Because it's an emotional thing. Imagine.
It's horrible!
Yes, exactly. So there would be a visceral response, right?
But I would really hope that I would never melt a baby head.
Fine. Oh, melting cars.
Why do you have to make it me?
Plastic baby heads.
Oh, okay. Your book,
I think, is doing that very interesting questioning that we associate so much with just general science fiction of the what if. And this is the what if. What if people had powers? What would our culture do in its present state? And I can't imagine that our culture would respond very much differently than how you presented the book. There may be some differences, but in terms of, I mean, I think the initial push would be, we need to control this.
Oh, yeah.
And then
I don't disagree with that in the slightest. I think that's been one of the nice things, Mike, about the fact that you have put in the two different storylines, is that we, Oscar Britton, you know, kind of an unconnected individual. He had the people he served with. But beyond that, he wasn't a family man. You know, he didn't have any great relationship with his parents. So him leaving the world wasn't like, you know, a huge blow to the larger society or his community.
Right.
Bookbinder is one of those people that is so completely mainstream. So it was nice to see, and I kind of wish that we had more perspective, and you said that we're going to find out more about his wife in the next one, but that we had more of a perspective of what was happening back home.
Do you remember at the end of Return of the King, the Scouring of the Shire?
Yes.
Yeah.
And one of the things that really impressed me about that was that Frodo and Sam and Merry and Pippin had gone off to defend this comfortable, cozy, happy, content, delightful way of life in the Shire, and came back so transformed by their experience in the War of the Ring that they were forever alienated from that, from the thing they set off to defend.
Well, it's PTSD, sort of, you know, everybody. Yeah.
Sure. I was really, really struck by that. And thought about that very, very heavily when I tried to figure out what latency would do to people, which is, again, what feeds into my answer to your question before. I just wouldn't want to be late no matter what, no matter how cool it would be.
Well, actually, that this does bring up a question I did want to ask about the powers, particularly physiomancy, because you have a number of characters in this particular book who are all physiomancers, but yet they respond to their power, their power responds to them, however you want to say it, in very unique ways. I mean, you have Therese, who is, who you have what's called rending, which is where you use your physiomancy power to basically tear apart the body, mm-hmm. right? Instead of healing it. And she has a visceral reaction to this idea of rending because for her, it feels wrong. And whenever she does it, she hates that she's done it. She hates herself for it. Right.
Sean, there's a reason for that too, which I don't know how much I alluded to. No, I did.
Yeah, you basically established that there's a scenario. I don't want to ruin it for potential listeners, but there is a reason why she did something and that's been her reaction. But then you have the other characters. There's the guy who calls himself Render,
mm-hmm.
who we learn basically is a sociopath. Or there probably is a more appropriate term for what to call him.
Sean, I'll tell you, Render is a fascinating, fascinating character.
I'm looking forward to more of him.
Well, he will. I'll tell you this right now. I'll give you an exclusive. He's almost guaranteed to have his own book down the road. That's how much I've thought about him. So he's
I don't think he's a sociopath.
Certainly not.
Well, okay. Based on what I read in this book, he has certain inclinations, which I find sociopathic.
You're wrong, Sean. I'm telling you right now, you're just plain wrong. Screw this whole every reader takes away something different. You're just Sean, wrong.
It's legit. It's totally legit. Keep going with it.
Anyway, but then there's, of course, the sculptor.
Yeah.
Right. So the Render is somebody who, there's more depth to him in this particular book. And there will be, of course, later, since you've basically just announced you're going to write more about him. But he is, I guess, almost, I can't recall if he's actually contracted, but he's like a contract hitman for the sort of underground pro Selfer movement.
He's not contracted. He's a member.
He's a member, right. He's not contracted, but he essentially kills people, presumably in self-defense. I don't know if I trust him enough to believe that, but I think he gets a little bit of too much pleasure out of killing. But but then there's the sculptor who we learn from the physiomancy powers
that he's a sociopath.
Right. Well, some of the ways that people can use physiomancy is they can actually manipulate their appearance. And the sculptor is, well, he's called the sculptor because he literally just, he just manipulates his appearance willy-nilly and is really good at it, and he's freaking psycho. And I find it so fascinating because I was reading this and thinking to myself, like, if physiomancy was the Force, is there like a light side to the Force and a dark side? Like, what is it that compels people to use these powers in these ways? Is it that they start using them in these sort of dark ways and that they just come to like it? Like, as though it's the Force, you know, it's the dark side, and you start practicing it and it's hard to stop? Or is it that people are already kind of screwed up in their own ways, either because of life experiences or for other reasons, and they are just inclined to use their powers in this way?
I would say that the big difference between my magic system and the metaphysical world of the Force, the concept of the Force before George Lucas ruined it by making it midichlorian or whatever the hell he did, damn it, because it was so awesome when it was a metaphysical thing.
I have no idea of what you speak. I must have blocked out this stuff from my memory. Yeah.
Well, that was probably... I wish I could do the same. But anyway, is that the light and dark side of the Force had a moral gravity accruing to them. Was a good side and a bad side and a yin-yang component there. Magic in my universe is neutral. There is no moral position either way. Physiomancy remains the ability to manipulate living flesh, just like necromancy is the ability to manipulate dead flesh. And that's all it is. It has no judgment either way. You may choose to use that power to knit flesh or to tear flesh or to do whatever you want with flesh.
Okay. So here's the question then. Is there a chemical response to the use of magic in terms of, can people become addicted to certain uses of it? Does it feel different doing one thing versus another? Is that all a conditioned response based on the psychology of the individual and the, you know, genetics of that person?
There's not a lot known about it. The fact is that there's a famous study group. I can't remember the name of it now. If it was the Sigma 6, or the Sigma 36, or whatever. But the results of that were heavily redacted when they were released out to the public. And what has been made available has been published in Arcana, which is sort of the major journal on the topic. The reality of it is what we do know is that magic is conducted through the limbic system of the brain, which is the center that controls emotion. And there are some people who speculate that because, frankly, illegal drugs have a similar conditioning response to it. But it's hard to find out because magic is so heavily regulated by the government, and the results are bottled up and kept classified, that without being able to establish proper control groups and having real diversity in the science of it, that the reality of it is not a lot is known.
I just say, I love how every time you answer things that about your world, you answer it as though we're actually living in that world. I mean, you're like, there's this journal, the, you know, Arcana, which is the major journal about the Brewers, and it published in 1999. Well, there was major.
What it tells us is that Mike has actually thought about his book. I mean, imagine that from an author.
No, I just mean it's very interesting because that's. Throughout this podcast, we've been treating this world almost as though it actually exists in the way we're asking questions, the way we're thinking about it, like Jen and I talking back and forth. And even now, Mike, even the way you're kind of, when we ask you a question and you kind of interject, I mean, you're not treating it as though, well, I thought this was going to be the way I would do it. No, you're saying, well, in the world, you know, this is what is X, Y, and Z is true. And I find that just really fascinating that clearly this is not like, you know, you just decided to write a fantasy book. You've really, really, really put a lot of attention into detail. Whether all those details are in the book or not is, I mean, some of them are.
No. Oh my God, I throw away so much. What little you get out of those epigraphs is the tip of the iceberg. But look, I mean, I don't think I'm unique in this respect among fantasy writers. And I had this conversation on a podcast that I was interviewed for last night. Not that I'm cheating on you guys or anything, but I remember reading, I was asked in an interview question, again, because I'm incredibly important, people want to hear me talk, what if there's any book I could read again for the first time, what would it be? And I said The Hobbit. And the reason I said that is that when I read The Hobbit now, it's really not that good. And I realized that what made that and the whole Lord of the Rings series so significant to me was when I came to it as a kid, was this sense of wide-eyed wonder at how real the world was. Mm. And that, you know, everyone told me it wasn't real, and I knew in the back of my mind that it wasn't real, but damn, man, it really felt real. Like if I just turned a corner the right way or, you know, opened a closet door, there it would be. As an adult, I can't capture that again, right? I mean, that's gone forever. But as an adult, I do realize that one of the reasons that it felt that way to me was that Tolkien had realized that world to such incredible depth, to the point of inventing languages. You can find genealogies of the important families of the story that go back, for years and for generations. And so, of course, as an adult, the best thing you can do is make your universe extrapolate well enough into reality that you give something of that sense of being transported that I got when I was a kid to other adults. And so, yeah, I mean, I spend a lot of time thinking about the realities of it. And frankly, I'm lucky enough to have beta readers that are of the same mind and that love to game. And by game, I mean, you know, like D&D game out your system and try to find the holes in it, try to break your rules, and then force you to shore them up and make them stronger. So, yes, I'm very proud of that, but I certainly don't think that's anything unique to me. I think you'll find, you know, scratch the surface of any fantasy writer, you're going to find that.
That's probably true.
So, speaking of breaking things, I did have a question because, this comes to, hopefully your beta readers brought this up to you because I thought it was very curious. You have the maps, which was a new thing to this book. At the beginning of the book, you show the source worlds superimposed over the normal worlds. Mm-hmm. And they are seemingly similar environments. Mm-hmm. And obviously, I haven't followed Bookbinder on his entire journey to India. But presumably, there's a very large ocean in between where he is and where he's going. Mm-hmm. So how is the source geography related to the real world geography?
It is very, very loosely related is the answer. There are some similarity. And again, we have a problem here because it's not really map. What little surveys exist are sketches that were done around Fob Frontier. And very, very little is known about the ecology of it. Although what you start realizing when you read the epigraphs in Fortress Frontiers that Simon Trulove, who's the necromancer that you meet in Control Point, has begun a book called Sojourn Among the Matam on Sora, which is starting to do the first anthropology of goblins that anyone's ever written. And you'll learn more about that and the significance of that in Breach Zone. So the reality of it is that there is presumably a very large ocean between those two spots. But actually, is there a very large ocean between those two spots? Clearly not, because Bookbinder was able to walk that distance.
Yeah, I found that curious because it was like, okay, it looked, I mean, they look very similar, at least in the map making that has been done at the beginning of the book.
I will concur that the loose outlines of the land do look
similar. Gotcha.
But I want to make one more point, too, which is that I think I've established very, very clearly that portomancy does not work between fixed points once the portomancer has control of their abilities. When Oscar Britton first manifests in portomancy, he cannot control his abilities, and he is gating to approximate points between where he is in Vermont and where he is in the source. But once he gains where, and the same is true for other portomancers that you encounter throughout the story.
Fascinating. Thank you.
Portomancy.
Yep.
It's a cool power. I don't know if that's the one I'd want.
It's a cool power, but it's also, it really, like, you know, Peter V. Brett, who I'm fortunate enough to have beta read for me from time to time, has always said that, you know, it's a cool power, but goddamn if it doesn't make it really, really hard to write a story because it's so powerful and it can do so much that it makes it really hard for you to make stuff happen in the plot, because, you know, Pete would always be like, wait, why is Britain fighting? Why doesn't he just get out of there and leave? And I would always be like, oh, shit.
Because he has a thing in his heart, at least in...
Yeah. Yes, I mean, in Control Point. I mean, but look, that's a perfect example. Like, I mean, I came up with that whole plot, and then I was like, wait, how do they keep him there? And that was what, and, you know, that was what gave birth to the idea of the ATTD. So.
Well, you'd have to. I mean, with somebody who can leave willy-nilly, right, you'd need some way to keep them fixed in a point if you don't already trust that individual. And in his case, I mean, he'd already essentially run in the first book at the start, right, when he found out. And he's like, I'm going to run. And then caught it. Right.
This entire conversation is part of the reason that I loved the Jumper book.
Oh, yeah. That was a great book. And I have a special affection.
Terrible movie, but...
Yeah. But Stephen Gould, who wrote that, was my instructor in Bible Paradise. And Jumper had just come out when I went to that workshop. And he's just a great guy. And he will likely be the next president of the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America Guild that... all of us pros are members of. And so, yeah, I mean, when I saw that book had been made into a movie, my heart just soared. It was so cool to see him hit that degree of success.
And there's a new book coming out.
Yep. And I'm very, very excited for it.
So it's pretty cool. But yeah, I mean, there's that connection there too. I mean, with the exception that Oscar Britton can jump between planes of existence. Although his limit is that he cannot... or at least as far as we know, he currently is incapable of porting within the same plane. He has to port to a different plane, then port back to the point he wants to get to.
Correct. Absolutely correct. Good catch. And one thing I do also want to mention is that, hey, I read Jumper long before I wrote Latent. So if you think that there's an influence of Jumper in Britton's abilities, you'd absolutely be right.
Well, but yeah, but that's okay. Borrow idea. I mean, let's be fair, porting, if we're calling it porting, but whatever the term has been used, I mean, this is an idea that has run through, I mean, even comics, right? I mean, or various forms of teleportation have always existed. I mean, like Nightcrawler is still one of my favorite Marvel characters, just because he's creepy looking and he can transport basically anywhere.
I would like his Eastern European accent.
That too, and he's got the cool tattoos, and I don't know. I just think he's kind of cool, and I just like to hang out with him.
Yeah, you know, I no doubt when the X-Men are gathering for a pre-mission brief, Nightcrawler turns to Colossus and goes, hey, you know that guy Sean does the Skippy and Fanny podcast? And Colossus looks at him and goes, who?
Ouch, dude.
I missed. Did I just miss like a major burn?
Yeah.
No, major.
He just burned me in a fictional universe.
Wow. Nice.
Dude, it was Colossus. It was Colossus. If it had been like Jean Grey, it would have been a different story.
Colossus doesn't know anything about pop culture, so I wouldn't worry.
There's Colossus.
But so, one of the questions I did actually want to have for you. And then we're getting a little long, I know you have to go.
Yeah.
So we'll probably close out pretty quick here. Well, since this is the first of your sequels, and there will be more, so it'll be a series, but what were some of your biggest concerns in writing essentially a sequel, and how did you sort of overcome them as a writer?
There is one thing about writing sequels, and I feel very confident in Fortress Frontier, and I hope that doesn't come across as egotistical. I think it's a better book than Control Point. I really think it's a very strong book. And I felt tremendous pressure that each book has got to be better than the one before it. And that God help you if you write a book that isn't as good as the one that came before it, because your audience will then be like, well, that's it. You know, he's hit his nadir. He's done. We're never going to read him again. And you're finished. And I felt that pressure in writing Fortress Frontier. I felt it twice as bad in writing Breach Zone, which I'm now working on the seventh draft to try to get it past my agent so that it can be turned in. And I can't tell you what that pressure feels like. It's the most frightening experience, because look, writing and being a writer is so unspeakably important to me. It's the thing that I've wanted to do all my life, the thing I never thought I'd get to do. And here I am doing it. And so, of course, instead of enjoying it, I sit here wringing my hands and wondering, you know, when the universe is going to take it away from me. And the surefire way that will happen is if I produce a stinker that doesn't live up to the expectations of the book before it. And, you know, reviews have been coming out for Fortress Frontier, and they've been uniformly celebratory. And they've all said this is a better book than Control Point, and we can't wait to see what he does with Breach Zone. And man, am I scared that when Breach Zone comes out, people will say, well, you know, it's not as good as Fortress Frontier, and, you know, now we're not so excited for book four. And how do I deal with that? I go out of my mind. I catastrophize. I panic. I go to pieces. I do all of the stuff that people do when they're confronted with, you know, the kinds of real life crises. And I also do the best work I can and hope to God that things work out. The remaining, you both already know that I've signed a contract for three more books, or rather, we have a deal in place for three more books in the series. Those are not going to be chronologically in order. Two of them are going to be prequels that are going to be taking place before Control Point. And the third one is going to follow an ancillary character that you meet in Fortress Frontier as a semi-standalone book. And, of course, I'm terrified that departure from orthodoxy in fantasy. The only other writer I know who's done something like that is Joe Abercrombie, and I am no Joe Abercrombie. I mean, that man is amazing. You know, what that will mean and how people will take that. I just can't encapsulate how that feels, and I can't encapsulate the kind of pressure that I feel like I'm under. I can only imagine, and man, I feel like I feel like I'm being so egotistical and being so grandiose, but I can only, you know what it's like? It's like the experience that Alan Bookbinder has when he steps up to take command with all of those lives counting on him. It's like the same way I felt, you know, when I was wheels up and on my way to Iraq, or when I took command of that command post I told you at Deepwater Horizon, you know, where there are real stakes and there are real people counting on me. And if I let them down, that has real consequences that will be with me for the rest of my days. And, that's a shaking experience, man. It really, really sucks. And I can totally see why artists go nuts. It was funny, you know, I'll never forget when Kurt Cobain killed himself. Not that I would ever do something like that or even contemplate that. But I remember thinking, man, why the hell would that guy do something like that? He was living the dream. He had all this money and he's famous and celebrated. Why would he? And going through the pressure of having to outperform myself with every novel, I am starting to get a glimmer of what could push someone to that kind of end. Granted, in a far, far less extreme degree, but
you understand the kind of pressure that does to somebody.
Yep.
Well, here's the good news. When your next book comes out, we'll have you on the show.
Well, you know what? It's all better now, man. Definitely. As long as I can be on the show, then who the hell cares about
I just thought that would help relieve a little pressure.
Dude, it does, because you got snowshoe cats.
Yeah, what about me?
And you know, Jen.
Exactly. Like, the coolest thing ever.
Yep.
Okay, so... All right, so we're going to close out in just a second here, but just really quick, the thing I wanted to say about Bookbinder is the reason why I really like that character is because I related to him as a person very much. Because I imagine if I ever were allowed to join the military, I would probably end up in a paper pusher position. Because I don't imagine myself having what it takes to do the combat side of things.
Which is why you would be great at. Every exactly. single person I have ever met who has said to me, I could never join the military, all of the best officers I've met, all of the best NCOs I've met, all of the real people that make our force as great as it is, every single one of them said, oh my God, I could never do this. And it is the guys who join the young Marines and like are like, hoorah, I can't wait to join up, that form the that frankly are not quite as good. And the best example of that is Admiral Mullen, who is I just have such unending admiration for that man. He never intended to join the Navy, and he certainly didn't intend to be the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and has said so in many, many interviews. So the fact that you say that, Sean, leads me to believe that if you did go in, and granted, yes, as smart as you are, you probably wind up in intel. But let's just say that you found yourself in a combat scenario. I think you'd probably do a lot better than you think you would.
Well, the only way that's going to happen is if they lower their standards really far. Because I have things. I'm asthmatic and cancer survivor, and
you know they give waivers for pretty much everything these days.
Certainly not. Wouldn't have to lower their standards for good looks, Sean. That's the important.
It's tough to get waivers for ingrown toes, nails too. I've heard.
Well, right now it's tough to get in. Period.
Exactly. That's true.
Everyone, their dog wants to be in the military. So,
but you know what? There's a draft. I'm in. So
yeah, man. Yeah.
I'm unlikely to be a draft dodger, but
have to remember about the military is it's the paper pushers that make the military work. So, just
that's true. Although I wouldn't mind working in like something like intelligence or something like that. That would be. I think I would enjoy that a lot.
No, you wouldn't.
Would you? I mean, it depends. It's one thing to be an analyst, Sean, but you could be a tactical questioner rolling with a fire team, going in on site or a site exploitation intelligence officer who's going to go in with a team that's hitting an enemy site and then doing the exploitation of the documents afterward. That's a very tactical, very combat heavy position, and that is intel.
I don't think you'd like the military, honey.
How would you know?
Because I know you.
That you don't know.
Huge on snowshoe cats. Huge on it.
Huge on. Yeah, that's true. They are.
Well, I could be that quirky like colonel who has a cat in his office.
You would not like making certain decisions that people in the military have to make.
What, like sending people to their death?
My unit has a dog. We have a giant golden retriever. We have a giant golden retriever named Harry, and he basically runs the place, and everybody loves him, and he goes everywhere. He's got his own life.
I love the pictures of him.
Yes, I put pictures of Harry all the time.
Oh, okay, so you don't think that I would be capable of making the decisions that would send people possibly to their death?
I don't think that you would enjoy making the decisions that would require other people getting killed.
Okay, who like what kind of sociopath sits down and go, well, I'm gonna
nobody
send
does
some people.
Nobody right. does enjoy that, but some
but
people
that point?
Have bigger moral not moral I shouldn't even say moral have bigger physiological responses to having to make those decisions with others. I don't think you would like it. I'm just saying you wouldn't like it. You could do it. You just really, really, really would not be happy about it.
I enjoy those semi-sweet mochi ice creams, you know, like the rice wrap around the small.
Those are pretty just, yummy.
And there's a few people in the military enjoy that. I'm not the only one.
See? Listen to Mike Cole, damn it. He's trying to boost up my ego, and you're trying to trample me down, man.
That's my job.
You. So anyway, so Fortress Frontier drops in stores. What is the exact date?
January 29th. I thought it was the 31st, but it's the 29th, so 7 days. To quote the movie The Ring, 7 days.
From the recording of this podcast, because I'm going to actually release it on the 28th.
Oh, outstanding.
So tomorrow his book is going to be out.
Oh, my God. I can't believe it.
So it's really awesome. So everyone should, I guess, technically pre-order the book.
Well, actually, I would like everybody, if they don't mind, to wait online outside the Barnes & Noble. And then the moment it opens on the day of sale, go in and buy all the copies of Control Point and Fortress Frontier. Then go home and order 10 more copies, paper copies, online. And have their relatives do the same. And if you all do that, I'll make the New York Times bestseller list.
Okay.
I'm a snowshoe cats for all.
Sorry, I think the one issue you're hitting here is that if everybody hoards copies of Control Points and Fortress Frontier, as you are suggesting, then no one will actually be able to read it.
Actually, the real fantasy there is that people will be able to find a bookstore to line up outside of because I don't think there's that many left. Yeah.
So thanks again, Mike, for demanding for us to interview you again at gunpoint, as it was.
He does not use guns outside of work, so he would never do that.
Oh, Jen! Jen, you are the most wonderful. This is why I will not come on the Skippy and Fanti show without Jen Bagley present.
Ouch.
You know me too. This isn't that I don't love you, Sean. It's just that Jen understands.
I just follow his Facebook page way too much, is really what it is.
That's right. That's right. Sean, look, you had me from Snowshoe Cat, so you don't have to worry about our affection.
But we're going to share a hotel and get in a giant bowl with salad dressing.
Always right? Have the Spartacus movie on constant loop.
All right. So everybody go check out Fortress Frontier. Comes out the 29th. Buy a billion copies. And Mike, it's been a pleasure.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
Cool. Anytime. And we'll see everybody some other day. I don't know. Whenever.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanti@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanti.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanti.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanti Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.